the actions of the Trump presidency revealed the dishonorable fact of the president's betrayal of his oath of office, betrayal of our national security, and betrayal of the integrity of our elections. I'm announcing the House of Representatives moving forward with an official impeachment inquiry. The president must be held accountable. No one is above the law.
In July, President Donald Trump called the Ukrainian PM Volodymyr Zelensky, and according to a complaint made by a US official with knowledge of that call, he urged Zelensky to investigate Joe Biden's son, Hunter, a director of Ukrainian business. The implication was that Trump was seeking to use a foreign country to damage a domestic political rival.
There was no quid pro quo. Look, it's just a continuation of the witch hunt. It's the worst witch hunt in political history.
In August, the Inspector General of the Intelligence Community received the complaint and decided that Congress should urgently investigate it. But last Thursday, Democrats in Congress heard that the White House had blocked them from hearing the details of the complaint. It was this that tipped the balance. Almost immediately, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi launched an impeachment investigation into the president. This was after months of her urging her colleagues to hold fire.
We have a president who believes there's no limit to his power. We have a president who believes he can do anything and get away with it. We have a president who believes he's above the law, pursuing the leader of another nation to investigate a political opponent.
Early on Thursday morning, Australian time, a memo describing the phone call, though not yet a full transcript, was released.
In fact, the press was asking questions of the president of Ukraine, and he said, no pressure. I used the word pressure. I think he used the word push, but he meant pressure, but it's the same thing. No push, no pressure, no nothing. Now, that's what they're accusing me of, but I didn't do it. I didn't threaten anybody. But they're getting hit hard on this witch hunt, because when they look at the information, it's a joke. Impeachment for that?
This week on Please Explain, we look into the impeachment process. Could this be the beginning of the end for the president, or just another round of partisan political warfare? Later on, we'll be speaking with senior fellow at the United States Studies Center, Bruce Wolpe, and Washington Post White House correspondent Anne Gearan. But first, our US correspondent, Matt Knott, joins us from New York. So, Matt, as we speak, and we should be clear to listeners that it's Tuesday evening in the US and you're on a side street near the United Nations building, what is the state of play concerning these impeachment proceedings?
Well, this afternoon, local time, the House Speaker, Nancy Pelosi, announced that the House, basically her, because she's the most powerful person there who controls this, will start an impeachment investigation against Donald Trump and get that process started that we believe will lead to impeachment. And it's an incredibly huge news story here in the US, particularly because Pelosi has been holding back for a long time a pressure to create impeachment.
Let me come to that in a minute, but since Pelosi decided to go ahead with an investigation leading to impeachment or an impeachment investigation, the White House has agreed to release details of this complaint to Congress. Is there any chance that that might cause the Democrats to pull back?
Well, we'll have to see. I don't think so, because it's hard for them to pull back now that they've made this decision to impeach. Many Democrats believe that Trump should have been impeached already for everything that we saw from the Mueller report. So I think they're stuck with it for now, even if it does prove that there's not as much to the Ukraine question as they would like.
Well, let's go into that. Trump's presidency so far has been a litany of scandal. There's been allegations of violations of the Emoluments Clause. There's been allegations of self-dealing, of sexual assault and related cover-ups. There's been allegations of improperly awarded security clearances. There have been indictments. There have been resignations. What was it about this case, do you think, that forced Nancy Pelosi's hand? As you've pointed out, and as we know, she has spent months trying to restrain members of her caucus from pursuing impeachment, and now she is leading the charge. What was it about this case?
Yes, that's the extraordinary thing, and how fast it's moved. It was only a week ago, even less, that the first inklings of this story came out in the Washington Post, and you compare that to the Russia issue, which went on for years and 18 months of investigations. This has been less than a week, and it's still so many questions about it, yet it has tipped the scales in a way that nothing else has until this point. I think the reason is that it is more understandable in a way for people. The suggestion that Trump is using his presidential authority to pressure another leader to investigate a potential opponent in the next election, the front runner to be his opponent. It sounds like Watergate on steroids, really, and it is much more understandable to people and an authority of presidential power than the Russia issue, which was, of course, when he was only a candidate. So that has really excited Democrats, and it has put Pelosi in the position of either impeaching him or being accused of enabling him to get away with this behavior. So she was really left with no choice.
So there was this sense now that even if she'd been able to impose some discipline on her ranks over the past months, that she came to realize that in this case, she couldn't hold back the floodgates. Is that it?
Yeah, that's absolutely it. Democrats have been saying, well, the reason why Trump would be pressuring the Ukrainian president to investigate Biden and his son is because there were no consequences for him from the Mueller issue. You know, the Mueller report strongly suggested that he had obstructed justice, and Democrats decided not to impeach him because they thought it wouldn't work for them politically. And people are now saying, well, that emboldened him and made him think he could get away with anything. And, you know, this could potentially interfere with the next election. Are we going to have a rerun of 2016 unless you do something? So many, many more people, Democrats in Congress, have been coming out for impeachment, including Democrats in moderate seats, you know, people who live in districts that voted for Donald Trump. They have in recent days been coming out for impeachment. So the tide turned in that way.
If that's the case, it means that the coming election becomes intertwined with an impeachment proceeding, doesn't it? If of course, there's no sudden off-ramp for the Democrats, if they're locked into this.
Yes, and that's what Pelosi has always been worried about. Her argument has been that Democrats should be focusing on the policy issues that work for them, on healthcare, on infrastructure, on improving working conditions for people, making it easier to go to college without getting huge amounts of debt. She's seen that as the good area for Democrats, whereas impeachment will get Republicans incredibly fired up with the suggestion that they're trying to remove Trump from office before his time is up. And the key question is how independent voters feel. Do they just see this as another a bit of news and chaos in Washington, it's just all part of the noise? Or do they see it as something that will change their minds about Trump? Or will they see it as a bad move on behalf of the Democrats? That's the key, because the lesson from the Trump presidency so far has been that things don't change. His approval ratings stay the same, basically, regardless of whatever happens. And is the drama of impeachment going to change that or not?
Well, that's the key question. I suppose we've seen those polls shift all the way from, 40 to 44. They never seem to fall outside of that. Is there any sense that people have that whatever the Democrats manage to find during this impeachment proceedings, that it will shift public opinion or Republican opinion about their president?
I don't think so. And it is especially hard to tell because this Ukraine story is so new. I don't think ordinary people would be able to tell you much about it because it's so fresh. And yet here we are with impeachment. On the Republican side, I think there's very little chance of Republican defections, people voting against Trump. You know, someone like a Mitt Romney in the Senate, when it gets to that, potentially could, maybe a couple of people in the House, but he has 90% approval among Republicans. So if you're a Republican politician who could potentially face a primary challenge from the right. There's no incentive to go against Trump, particularly as you're getting closer to an election. They're stuck with him as their candidate, so they're going to go down fighting for him. And I don't think public opinion in that way will come into it. It's what Democrat supporters are pressuring their side of politics to do, and what Republican supporters are pressuring their side of politics to do. This is just the ultimate example of how polarized politics has become here.
So you don't see any chance of Republican senators suddenly discovering their independence as an arm of government, and depending on what the outcomes of the investigation are, choosing to vote against the president?
Well, we don't know what's going to come out. That is the question. If there was the absolute smoking gun, to use a cliche, of evidence of terrible wrongdoing by Trump, would they turn against him en masse? So far, everything we've seen says no, that there's a transactional relationship here between Trump and the party. Their support allows him to stay in office, and he allows them to get done the things they want to do. Conservative judges on the Supreme Court, tax cuts, restrictions on abortion. He's giving them what they want, and it's not in their interest so far to turn against him.
How has it coloured proceedings at the UN? You have nearly every foreign leader in the world at the UN at the moment, within a few blocks of where you're standing. Is this story overwhelming it, at least from the American perspective? And has it reduced the impact that the United States has as a global leader at the United Nations?
I think domestically it has been the big issue here in America. I think people overseas are finding it hard to get their head around exactly what's been going on. I must say Trump has been behaving in publicly pretty much as normal. He hasn't seemed more perturbed than usual. And these are the fights that he loves, really. He didn't look particularly bothered. He gave his regular speech to the UN about attacking China, defending national sovereignty, attacking Facebook and the other tech giants for censoring free speech. He was speaking about the things that he usually talks about.
Is there a sense that other nations are beginning to speak with one another more than they might once have? That the world order is continuing on without the presence of the United States and its key allies?
Yes, absolutely. Well, this is the second day of the UN. The first day was very focused around climate change and what countries are doing to combat climate change. And Trump was not speaking. He appeared in the audience for a moment, but the US, the biggest emitter in the world, pretty much tied with China, was totally absent. And that's the void at the heart of this. So the other countries aren't, and they're not even speaking about it. They're not criticizing Trump. They're not trying to get him to change his mind. They've accepted that while he's in power, the US is going to do nothing significant about reducing emissions. So countries are saying we're going to have to do it without the US. They're just factoring in Trump as someone who has to be waited out until he's replaced with another leader.
Now, a piece you wrote, I think, in the past 24 hours has highlighted that Australia's been in lockstep over that. Tell us what the Prime Minister was doing while the rest of the world was discussing climate change.
Yes, well, of course, that's the thing, is that all this impeachment talk and this Ukraine story with Trump has coincided exactly with Scott Morrison's visit to the US. And we saw this firsthand during the state dinner at the White House, and that whole day, which was such a big deal for Australia, the journalists here were entirely focused on the Ukraine issue and trying to get answers from Trump on that. They weren't asking about Australia and US relations. That wasn't of interest to them. And so, yes, the remarkable thing about this visit, even more than people had expected, is how closely Scott Morrison has positioned himself to Donald Trump, particularly on China. He's been very sharp on his arguments that China is a developing country and a developed country, sorry, and needs to be treated as such. And it's been unclear who's echoing who here, because Morrison and Trump have been saying exactly the same thing. And neither leader spoke at the climate change summit. Scott Morrison was in Chicago, of all places, where he gave a speech, and he visited an innovation hub. One of the photos we had was showing him looking at this smart drive-through McDonald's technology that he was looking at, and that was as the world leaders were talking about climate change. So it's been an unusual visit in that way.
Also, while in the Midwest, Mr. Morrison attended a rally with Trump. It wasn't literally a campaign rally, but I've got to say it looked exactly like a campaign rally. How has that been received? Was that an unusual thing for an Australian Prime Minister to do while in the United States in the lead-up, the long lead-up, but the lead-up to a presidential election?
Definitely an unusual thing for an Australian Prime Minister to do. And I know that there would have been concern from the Prime Minister's office about what Trump was going to say. Particularly at his rallies, he relaxes being surrounded by supporters, and there would be the feeling of, what is he going to say standing next to the Prime Minister? And is the Prime Minister going to be dragged into supporting it? This was also an issue at the Oval Office. I think Trump didn't say anything too remarkable, which would have been a relief for the Prime Minister. But yes, it's not your normal event for two leaders to do. It just so happened that on the exact same day, Trump did a much, much larger rally with the Indian Prime Minister in Houston. Now, that was on the front page of papers like the Wall Street Journal. That was about 15,000 to 20,000 people in an arena. So that very much overshadowed the smaller Australian visit. But it is becoming something that foreign leaders are doing to stay in the good books with Trump.
Can you stay in the good books for Trump for very long, though? Has that been the experience of other leaders?
Well, no, and it hasn't been the experience with his staff members either. Most people have come in and out of favour. Trump likes them, and then eventually, if you ever push back on him or say, no, we can't do that, then you're promptly sacked. So Australia's got to hope. There has been a lot of effort put into convincing him about the idea of this alliance that has lasted for 100 years, that we're a dependable ally, we don't rip America off on trade. If America goes to war, we go with them. So there have been efforts to combine the personal chemistry between the leaders with arguments about Australia as a good country to be doing business with and to be an ally with. So the Australian government will be hoping that carries through.
This leads, I suppose, to my final question. All the way through, the theme that Australians were using to try and impose upon Trump the significance of that relationship was mateship. They had those mateship badges made up, I noticed. There were mateship posters. Do you have a sense of what Americans make of the word mateship? Does it make any sense to them?
I don't think so. There is a logo that someone created, I don't know if people have seen, which is merging the American eagle with a kangaroo, and it looks like this kind of mutant creature. And so I don't know how all that goes down. It's not their lingo, but you did hear it a bit with some of the leaders, the senior politicians, including Trump, using some of this rhetoric in the speeches, which obviously written by their staff, but they have used the word mateship, which is not in the American vernacular. So it does show that the very intense lobbying campaign that's gone here from Australia has worked. It's been completely bipartisan. I know Democrats in Congress also have been saying Australia is a good ally, don't annoy Australia of all people. They've been saying, you know, this is a friend you want to have in the world. So they've gone along with it. We have different political cultures, so I think the view is that you can't be too subtle or nuanced with your messaging to America. You have to hit them over the head with it, and that's what I think we've done.
Well, I think you're going to have a very busy few months coming up. Thank you so much for talking with us.
No worries at all. Thank you.
Matt Knott is our US correspondent in New York.
Hi, I'm Michael Batchelard. I'm the investigations editor at The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald. The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald have by far the country's biggest investigations teams, breaking stories about corruption, crime, and social and political issues. We also have foreign correspondents in Asia, China, Europe, and the US. Both are expensive, but crucial to providing news for and by Australians that help our readers interpret the world. And if people value that, we need people to subscribe so we can keep doing it. Subscribers allow us to dig deeper into the important stories that matter to our readers.
It's Thursday afternoon in Washington, D.C., and since we began recording Please Explain, there have been huge developments at the White House. A memo describing the phone call between Ukraine's newly elected president, Volodymyr Zelensky, and US President Donald Trump has been released. To get the perspective of someone at the heart of this story, we're joined by White House correspondent for The Washington Post, Anne Guerin. Anne, thanks for joining us. It looks as though any hope that the White House might have had that releasing a memo about the contents of this conversation, that might have dissuaded Democrats from pursuing impeachment, it looks as though that's not going to happen. Can you explain to us the key points that we found out in the memo and the impact that that has had?
Sure. So what came out today was a transcript, actually sort of a transcript done after the fact, of a call between the president and the president of Ukraine back in July. And Trump has been saying for days that the conversation at the heart of what has become an impeachment inquiry in the House of Representatives would exonerate him, would show, as he said, that it was a perfect call and that there had been no pressure, improper pressure applied to the Ukrainian leader. And what the transcript of that was released today, which is quite unusual in itself. Most of these calls and discussions are classified at some level, although there doesn't appear to have been anything in this one that would have necessarily been classified. But still, they're not things that the White House just hands out. And the fact that the president did order its release today is kind of an extraordinary measure. And what it shows is actually quite up for debate. People who believe the president has done nothing wrong point to the fact that there's no explicit quid pro quo outlined in the conversation. And those who think the president was up to no good say that that quid pro quo is implied because he talks on in one moment about a military aid to Ukraine that has been held up, and in the next moment he asks President Zelensky for a favor.
He also talks about this server, which he seems to believe this is the server that some people believe the DNC refused to give up to the FBI for analysis after the DNC was hacked by Russia. Now, that seems to me to be a discredited story. Was anyone surprised that Trump started asking the president of Ukraine, the prime minister of Ukraine, to look into this server?
I guess I wasn't surprised. We haven't heard that much about that particular storyline and for some time, but it's one that the president has returned to numerous times. Certainly, it started way back when he was running for president, and he's returned to it since. And it's not the only discredited theory or conspiracy theory that the president brings up. There have been others. And he does do it sometimes with foreign leaders, and he does it in other settings as well.
Since the memo was released, there has been reporting on the fact that government agencies have been wrestling with this for a couple of months. What have we learned since the memo was released?
Yeah, that actually is a very interesting element of this, is that in the conversation, President Trump talks to President Zelensky about the possibility of the U.S. Attorney General, William Barr, who heads the Justice Department and obviously works for Trump, but also was supposed to be, part of a semi-independent part of the government, that Barr might be able to offer some help, and that they could talk about how to go about a corruption investigation in Ukraine that the president makes pretty clear is aimed at looking to see whether former Vice President Joe Biden or Joe Biden's son did something wrong. That drags a number of other people into this conversation. It drags another government agency into this conversation. And of course, we have the intelligence agencies. We don't know which one, but somebody somewhere down in the bowels of the U.S. intelligence apparatus was the first to raise an alarm about this and brought forth the whistleblower complaint that we reported on last week and that got this whole thing rolling. So you have Congress, you have the Justice Department, you have the intelligence agencies, and you have the White House.
Historically, or over the past couple of years, scandals seem to slip off the president, off Donald Trump. Throughout the day-to-day, and his own party, especially in the House and the Senate, stick by him very firmly. Have you had the sense today and in the past couple of days that he is being supported as fully and strongly as he has been in the past, or is some of that support showing signs of wear and tear?
I mean, in public, the support appears to be just as strong. You had Lindsey Graham and other Republican senators today signing up readily to the president's claim that the transcript shows that he had done nothing wrong. The Post have reported from my colleagues today that there's a fair amount of queasiness on the part of a number of congressional Republicans who feel that not only does this issue look really bad for the president, but even if it turns out to not to stick, it will be a huge distraction, the way the Mueller investigation was, that stops the not only the White House, but Republicans in Congress from being able to get very much done.
And do you have a sense of the mood within the White House?
I do. I mean, I'm here in New York with the president as he attends the UN meeting where all this unfolded over the last few days. And certainly the mood among those traveling with him and his closest aides here is a little bit of a bunker mentality. They're worried about this. They feel that they're being treated unfairly in the press as a result of it. But they are a little worried and queasy. You can feel that in some conversations. And then my colleagues in Washington have been reporting versions of the same, that there's a certain, you know, a certain air of resignation among some people who work for the president. You know, another, here we go again. This is going to, you know, this is all we're going to do for the next several months.
Does it feel different to previous scandals?
It is markedly different because it's produced an impeachment inquiry. I mean, that's where all of this has been leading. And by this, I mean all of the president's various scandals and the Russia probe and the Mueller report were, you know, that was the thing that defined the first 2 years of the administration. What would happen when that report was complete? What would we find out? And would it lead to an impeachment inquiry? Democrats took the House in the middle of all of that. The report came out, and it did not lead to an impeachment inquiry. The president claimed exoneration at the time, and it's really just a day later that he's having this after Mueller's testimony was all sort of said and done, that it was clear that Democrats were not going to move for an impeachment based on what Bob Mueller found and told them about. It was a day later that the president has this call with President Zelensky, and the contents of which did, in fact, lead to an impeachment inquiry.
And what are we waiting for next? Is the next telling moment going to be when or if this whistleblower testifies before the House Intelligence or Congressional Intelligence Committees?
Yeah, I mean, there'll be sort of there's an intermediate step where the contents of the whistleblower complaint may become public. That complaint or a version of it was delivered to Congress today. Things leak from Congress, so we'll find out there. But then, yes, there may be testimony if that person is compelled to testify and isn't protected somehow from doing so. That would be a rather extraordinary development, and I don't know how Congress could possibly keep that person's identity secret. Maybe they would try. Maybe the White House will somehow insist that that person's identity not be kept secret, and that raises a host of other questions. So yes, there could be testimony. There'll be testimony tomorrow Thursday from the Inspector General of the intelligence agencies, who is the person who had flagged this whistleblower complaint and kind of got this whole thing rolling. Now, he is a Trump appointee, but he is also the Inspector General. He's supposed to be sort of an umpire, basically, calling balls and strikes. And in this case, he felt that this complaint was serious enough that it needed to move forward. He'll testify tomorrow. And then beyond that, of course, there's the question of what Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, actually does now that she has said she will initiate impeachment proceedings. What happens next?
It's hard to imagine that they're going to take a backward step now, isn't it? You can't really end this process, can you?
No. I mean, they're not going to, she's not going to all of a sudden say, okay, you know, no harm, no foul. We're actually not going to try to have an impeachment trial. I mean, impeachment is it's an odd term, but what it basically means is that the House attempts to act as prosecutor and draws up a prosecutorial document, the way a prosecutor would in court, and then attempts to act on that. Just as it was at the time that this was a question in the Mueller case, you know, the Republicans still control the Senate, and it would be an impeachment inquiry would end in a trial in the Senate, and it seems just as unlikely now as it did before that a Republican-controlled Senate would, when acting as a jury, would do anything to convict the president.
Thank you so much for your time on what must have been an incredibly busy day.
Sure, no problem. Happy to help.
Anne Geeran is Washington Post White House correspondent and former chief diplomatic correspondent for the Associated Press. Bruce Wolpe is a senior fellow at the United States Studies Center, but in the past he served as both an advisor to Prime Minister Julia Gillard and to Democrats in the US House of Representatives. Bruce, can you start by talking us through the process of an impeachment? Obviously, the House Speaker has announced she wants to pursue an investigation leading to the impeachment. What happens next? What does this literally mean?
It literally means that the Judiciary Committee will take the lead on this. What the Speaker has done is ask all the committees of jurisdiction that have an interest in these affairs. And so they go to the Oversight Committee, which has a broad scope over how the government functions. The Intelligence Committee, which we're seeing with the Ukraine affair as that unfolds. The Ways and Means Committee that wants Trump's tax returns. So all the committees that have been involved in their constitutional oversight of the executive branch have been asked to make their best case for or against or whatever the president's activities, to channel those to the Judiciary Committee. And it is the Judiciary Committee that will then decide whether to vote to approve articles of impeachment by the committee and recommend those articles to the House. So we will see over the next several weeks that this unfolding, and between now and Christmas will be the decisive moments in the next in this process.
So these committees will, under Pelosi's guidance, it appears likely now, draft articles of impeachment. They'll decide what to impeach Trump for, basically. Is that right?
Yes. The interesting question is, what caused this week? Why did it explode this week? You've had the Mueller report 2 years of investigations on Russia, 2 years of investigations on possible obstruction of justice of the Russia investigation by the president and people around him. That did not reach critical mass on impeachment. But what has been constant throughout has been the frustration of the Congress, of the House of Representatives under Democratic control, in getting information from the executive branch so that it can properly do its job of oversight under Article 1 of the Constitution. We appropriate the money for the government to function. How is that spent? What are these officials doing? And at every turn, the White House has said, you're not getting this witness. You're not getting these documents. We're not cooperating with you. And they have stonewalled them. And I worked in the House for 10 years. And it's come to a point where the institution, these members of Congress understand political survival most. And they know that impeachment could be a perilous course. But they've reached a point where they're saying, you are stopping us from doing our job. We have to protect the institution of the House of Representatives. And that's why we are doing this. So that's the common thread among all these things: obstruction of Congress's right to have oversight of the executive branch.
But as you say, and as one of our other guests has alluded to, there are so many potential causes to prompt someone to pursue impeachment or Congress to pursue impeachment. It's almost as though at the moment they've got to decide what not to pursue impeachment over. And in this case, they appear determined to focus on Ukraine. Is that the case?
It is, because you can get it in one compared to all the other stuff. And what I mean by that is, if the equivalent would be if the Prime Minister of Australia asked the President of China to investigate the Labour Party's ties to institutions in China, tell me how Australians would feel about that. And so when you have the President asking the President of Ukraine, newly elected, and he's promising he wants to give aid to Ukraine, but he's tying all these things together. And saying, we want you to open a corruption investigation of Joe Biden, a former vice president who happens to be Trump's main political opponent. Everyone gets this. It's never been done before. And so they want to get to the bottom of it. And does that warrant impeachment of the president? And that's why it exploded this week.
So once these articles are drafted, they will then go back to the Congress and ask them to vote whether or not to pursue impeachment. Is that right?
Yes, effectively, it's an indictment. And it goes to the floor of the House of Representatives, and then it's up or down on a majority vote, a simple majority, not a supermajority. As Democrats have 218 is a majority of the House. Democrats have 240 votes. There may be a couple of Republicans who come along. So if it's presented to the House, I don't have any doubt that the House will impeach the president.
So then it's referred to the Senate. And the Senate, obviously, is held by the Republican Party, and it's very determined to back Trump. What happens there? How could you imagine if it goes forward to that point? What do you think would happen in the Senate?
Well, we've seen this before when President Clinton was impeached in 1998. And what happens is that the Senate holds a trial on the impeachment, and the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court presides over that trial in the Senate. Leaders of the House Committee, Judiciary Committee, become the prosecutors, and they take their case to the senators. The senators sit every day, as long as this continues, in their chairs in the Senate. So you have 100 senators sitting at their seats, and witnesses are called and examined and deposed. And at the end of that process, and of course, the defense, it makes its case, and the president will have attorneys in the chamber. I don't know whether the president would care to testify or whether he will or not. You know, that's to be seen. President Clinton did not testify in the Senate. And then the Senate will deliberate and vote. But a vote to convict requires a two-thirds supermajority, or 67 senators. There are 54 Republican senators.
And given the culture of the Republican Party at the moment, it seems very difficult to imagine that whatever they hear, whatever they might hear, should this go ahead, they will vote to convict the president. Is that a fair assumption?
It is at this stage. But, you know, that was the feeling when impeachment started with Richard Nixon, and the Republican Party was united behind him. But at the end of the day, evidence emerged of such an explosive nature that people felt that Nixon was unfit for office. And a delegation of Republicans went to him, led by Barry Goldwater, the great conservative, and presented their view to it, and Nixon resigned. Now, I'm not saying at all that history will be so repeated, but we really will have a good idea within the next few days when the evidence in the Ukraine matter is presented, and then people can make their judgment as to whether this is really explosive or whether it is a witch hunt, as the president has said, and he's been on Twitter all day countering this, decrying this, retweeting Fox News on this, and saying it is a witch hunt and getting his allies to support him.
Well, let's go to that now, because you've talked us through the mechanics of impeachment. Let's go to the politics of impeachment. Pelosi has, for a couple of years now, she's been the one saying to her own side, let's not go down this path. She's been holding them back. Why has that been?
The American people don't support impeachment at this time, at least as we speak today in real time. We'll see if that judgment changes. So it's never been seen as politically popular because the case wasn't made by Mueller, where it was just so plain as day, black and white. Crimes were committed. He's unfit to be president. Get him out of office. Most Americans feel you want to remove the president, remove him at an election. An election is coming. It's a year from now. And so why go through all this, which will paralyze the country, dominate the press, prevent anything else almost from being done? It's an extraordinary situation.
Well, but as you've explained to us so far, Pelosi could no longer hold back. The Congress had decided it had to act.
It had to act. These members are feeling they couldn't do their job. And so it just came to this make or break point.
As you've explained, Pelosi decided she had to let slip the dogs. So it's happening. That being the case, it now appears likely that the Democratic Party is going to be fighting the president through an impeachment process and at the same time is going to be running an election campaign. It's also conceivable that the impeachment process will become, well, we know it is, it's a very political process. So in this campaign, the Democratic Party is going to have to be defending Joe Biden and his honour, while at the same time mounting a case against Trump. Does this effectively knock Biden out of the race, or does it shore him up as the effective candidate? I mean, how does it affect the election campaign?
If it's shown that he was wronged and smeared, it helps him because it vindicates his position, and he's exhibit A of a president determined to destroy his enemies. And so I think it would work in his favor. If it's ambiguous or if the case isn't there, yeah, I think that will hurt. That will hurt. But the fact is we're really in new territory where these attacks by the White House on a prime candidate of this nature, we've never seen anything like it before. So we don't know how it's going to play out. At the same time, you have a whole bunch of other competitive candidates, especially Elizabeth Warren, who has taken a very vigorous position that Trump is unfit for office and should be removed. And she's resonating with Democratic voters. But the bottom line question is, will the American people want to vote for Democrats at the end of this process? And we do not know that today. But it is a real risk for Democrats as to whether they can be successful in November 2020. Absolutely.
It's a particularly difficult position for Elizabeth Warren to be in, though, isn't it? Because we're going to have many months now, it appears anyway, of a political discussion involving Biden and Trump to the exclusion of Warren, because we're going to be focused a lot on this. Does that make it difficult for her to campaign?
No. And just going back to where Democrats are, a couple of things. One, there's been a strong reservoir of support for Joe Biden. He served 8 years admirably as vice president. He's very respected in the party. He's deeply experienced. People know he can do the job. What Democratic voters, as polls assess their mood, what they want is, number one, someone who can beat Trump, and then number two, and that is a more important factor than whether the ultimate candidate aligns with their issues. There has been a judgment so far that Biden is the most potent candidate against Trump. That's what the polls were showing. And that's why Trump trying to take him out on Ukraine is such a blatant political act. Warren, though, is really cutting through on more progressive left issues on the power of corporations, on equity and income, education, healthcare. and other things. And her polls are rising, and to the point where she's practically at parity with Biden. So I think for Warren, she sticks with her guns, continues to prosecute her case. If something happens to Biden, she's there. If Biden is vindicated, that's fine. Democrats stuck together. Democrats, make your choice as to who's best to go against Trump. So both of them will be tested, along with the others in the field, as to who has the strongest standing. And we'll see this by early in the year, who's up and who's down at the end of this process and where Joe Biden ultimately comes out.
Now, unlike most of the commentators we speak to on American politics, you have expertise in Australia as well. You've served as an advisor to Julia Gillard. So I'm interested in asking you, this is happening against the backdrop of two things, Scott Morrison's visit to America and the UN General Assembly. And I'm curious as to your view on this. Do you believe that the United States, its standing in the world is being damaged by this? And secondly, how does it affect an Australian Prime Minister who has so clearly forged a close relationship with Donald Trump? Does it embarrass him at all, or does that remain a very useful thing for an Australian leader?
On the second question first, we have one president at a time. And I think Prime Minister Morrison did a very, very good job, an excellent job in establishing one of the strongest working relationships with Trump, which will benefit Australia. He's able to prosecute Australia's interests in the most effective way by virtue of having that relationship. So I think that worked. And it's to his credit that he was able to engineer that. As far as America standing in the world, this does hurt. Just as Boris Johnson is hurt by constitutional processes underway in the United Kingdom. I remember when President Clinton convened the Camp David summit on Mideast peace with Yasser Arafat and the Israeli Prime Minister. It was post-impeachment. And then you have to, and those negotiations failed. So you have to wonder, is the effectiveness and standing of the president undercut by going through an impeachment process? Are they weaker? And the answer is yes. So will Trump have more moral authority to marshal the world for his America First agenda? The answer is no. Will Trump stay true to his beliefs? Yes, but America will be less effective in the world because this is going on at home.
Thank you so much for making all of that so clear, Bruce.
Thank you, Nick. I'm glad. I mystified myself, but thank you so much.
Bruce Wolpe is a senior fellow at the United States Studies Center and was an advisor to Democrats in Congress in Washington. Thanks to our Please Explain guests this week, Matt Knott, Bruce Wolpe and Anne Geeran. Please Explain is brought to you by the newsrooms of the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. Subscriptions power our newsroom. To support independent journalism, search, subscribe, Sydney Morning Herald or The Age. Please Explain is produced, researched and edited by David Escort and Nicole Purcell. Technical assistance by Yuji Shimada. Amelia Maguire helps with logistics and planning, and Tom McKedrick is our head of audio. I'm Nick O'Malley. Thanks for listening.